This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Daly. Our guest this week is Donnell Rehagen, CEO of Clean Fuels Alliance America. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with Clean Fuels' Donnell Rehagen next. Today's Open Mic segment is brought to you by America's crop insurance industry, which is thankful for the continued support of farmers, commodity organizations, rural businesses, lenders, and lawmakers who are fighting to maintain a strong farm safety net. Providing individualized protection on more than 540 million acres of farmland, crop insurance remains the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. Clean Fuels Alliance America began with the National Biodiesel Board. But instead of just representing soybean oil as a feedstock and biodiesel as a fuel, Clean Fuels represents biodiesel, renewable diesel, and sustainable aviation fuel from a wealth of feedstocks, including soybean and canola oil, used cooking oil, corn oil, and animal fats. CEO Donnell Rehagen says the 4.6 billion gallon industry is poised for growth and ready to serve a variety of industries and consumers of renewable transportation fuel. But they need realistic vision from Washington.
The RFS, you know, in all honesty, has been a little bit underwhelming to us. We've always believed that we could do more than the EPA would recognize for us. And that continues to be the situation we find ourselves in. So when I said 4.6 last year, we're on pace this year to likely reach 5 billion gallons this year. And so where could that 5 billion be if the EPA actually gave us an RVO that kind of challenged our industry or at least recognized where our industry actually is? Because what we're doing is we're producing over what they're telling everybody that we should. And so federal policy can serve us well if it's doing, you know, if it's challenging us to grow and expand. It can also hold us back if we're not careful. And so that's why Clean Fuels Alliance America is, a critical organization for our industry to try to make things work out at the federal and state level from a policy and a regulatory standpoint.
From a domestic or a global demand standpoint, what could you be?
Well, domestically here in the United States, it's a lot of the stories about feedstock availability. I mean, that's going to be an indicator of how big our industry can grow. Now, we launched a vision in 2020 to be a 6 billion gallon industry by 2030. So that was a 10-year window. And, you know, at that time when we were setting that vision, we were about maybe 2.5 billion gallons. So it was substantial growth we were projecting that we could accomplish in about a decade. Well, I just mentioned that we're probably going to be 5 billion gallons this year. So we've almost doubled from 2020 through 2024. So we're well on our way to that, reaching that 6 billion gallon goal and likely well ahead of 2030. And so then the question, as you ask, is how big can you be? And I think a lot of that just kind of depends on the signals that are being sent to our industry domestically, but also globally, as far as demand for the fuel and then where those policies come into play. Again, domestically and internationally, you know, to support the production and the use of those fuels. And so, you know, our long-term vision is by 2050 to be a 15 billion gallon industry. And I think the biggest challenge to keep us away from that right now is going to be feedstock and feedstock availability.
Other than feedstocks, what are the headwinds that are holding you back from finding greater growth?
You know, I think, Jeff, you know, we continue to have pockets, although, again, it's way better than it used to be, you know, of OEMs, original equipment manufacturers, who want to have questions or concerns about using our fuels or using our fuels in higher blends. We find widespread support for our fuels, but as you know, diesel engine technology changes, and it's pretty massive when you think about You find diesel engines in railroad locomotives. You find different diesel engines in marine vessels. You find different engines in over-the-road trucks, and you find different diesel engines in farm equipment and different in diesel engines in pickup trucks. And so there's such a wide variety of diesel engine technology that's out there. Making sure that our fuels, biodiesel, renewable diesel in the on-road sector, can work in every single one of those, that's probably our biggest challenge going forward. We continue to have a very robust technical program funded most in part by the U.S. Soybean Checkoff Program that continues to try to knock down those barriers, answer those questions, make those OEMs comfortable. It's also great for them to hear from their customers, whether those are large fleets like a PepsiCo, who's now members of Clean Fuels Alliance America, reaching out to their suppliers and saying, hey, we want to make sure going forward that our engines that we can use biodiesel and renewable diesel as we try to meet our carbon reduction goals.
So when the Treasury offered their rules for 40B, which was much later than the tax credits were available, some were very disappointed that there was so many strings attached to what would qualify for those credits. While your meeting was going on in Washington, the Secretary of Agriculture spent time with you and Tom Vilsack, opening a period of time of saying, we're looking for answers toward 45Z. How important is this definition that's pending for beginning 2025?
Yeah, so 40B, you know, it was the Sustainable Aviation Fuel Production Tax Credit. And you're right, that credit expires at the end of this calendar year. And there, quite frankly, is not a large amount of production that's in place right now. So 40B was what we viewed as being the predecessor to 45Z, which is the Clean Fuels Production Tax Credit. That was part of the IRA bill a couple of years ago. And so that's going to be the new set of rules that's going to dictate what happens in ethanol from a tax credit perspective, what happens in biodiesel, what happens in renewable diesel, what happens in sustainable aviation fuel, what happens with RNG. Basically, any clean fuel gets sort of the program and the tax treatment of those fuels gets set and established by 45Z. So that's kind of the way to think about it. So you're right, Secretary Vilsack was very generous with his time and came over, spent over an hour with our membership and our governing board talking about some of these issues. I really, really appreciate the guy. I mean, he is very sincere, very, very knowledgeable, and he's kind of got a challenge on his hands because clean fuels is not a USDA program, right? You mentioned Treasury will be the one, because it's a tax credit, will be the one promulgating the final rule. And so there's an interagency process that's been going on to try to figure out what's the best way. And so the outcome of 40B, that went through that interagency process, you're right. It has some flaws, and the Secretary acknowledged some of those. So what he's doing through this request for information was he's saying, hey, we want to be your advocate at the interagency level as we try to finalize the ruling for 45Z. We need more information. We know a lot about agriculture, but we want to know what you all think about agriculture. We want to know what you all think about what should be in and what should not be in the final rule for 45Z. Their goal is the same as ours. They want to see it 45Z result in a lot of agricultural participation in renewable fuels going forward. And so they have a chance through this process to try to affect what the final rule is in 45Z and maybe make it better, especially for agriculture, make it better than what 40B was. And that's really what he's trying to do, and I applaud him for that.
This is Senator Grassley from Iowa. I'm going to paraphrase what he said in a press conference and talking with media. And he was critical in the 40B of the bundling, where for soybean oil to qualify, it had to have both cover crops and planted no-till. For corn, there was a combination of three different things that had to be accomplished, and cover crops were one of them. According to our standards from from the USDA, you can't plant a cover crop till the harvest is done. And in many states, when the harvest is done, the ground is frozen. You can't plant a cover crop in frozen ground. There's some things that just didn't make sense. And he was very opposed to the bundling and looking forward to some common sense into the rule. Are those the things we're looking for here?
That is exactly one of the things that we're looking for here. Again, that bundling, as you refer to it was sort of one of the flaws in 40B. There was not a recognition there that some of those practices that were being bundled and required to all happen, all three in the sense of corn production, both of them in the sense of soybean production. You had to do either both or all three, or it didn't make any sense to do any. So it's an all or none approach. And it just wasn't feasible. And so fortunately, that was the final ruling for 40B. Again, the SAF tax credit, not a lot of use of that tax credit anyway. The 45Z, that needs to really get fixed. And so those were some of the things that we spoke with the Secretary about, and I'm sure that's going to come through loud and clear in this request for information. The challenge, though, as I said, Secretary Vilsack doesn't get to finalize and promulgate that final rule. He's going to be one voice at the table as they talk about what needs to be improved between 40B and 45Z. So we need to arm him, and this RFI, request for information, is going to be that process. So all of your listeners who are involved in commodity trade associations need to be engaging with them and making sure that they're going through this process. This RFI is it's a very short time frame, 30 days, so it's due by the end of July. And so I know I can speak for us, we're already working on it as we speak, and that's a very important top priority for us, as it should be for all the commodity groups and renewable fuel groups going forward.
You mentioned a number of feedstocks that you're able to take advantage of. And when I spoke with the National Oilseed Processors Association, an industry that certainly does stand to gain, especially if we're able to use more soybean oil, they are seeing challenges, though, from used cooking oil. Senator Grassley and other members of legislature have raised issues that we've gone from 200 million pounds to 3 billion plus pounds of used cooking oil. And they don't seem to suggest that there is specific criteria to make sure that what we're receiving is actually used cooking oil. Is your group concerned about definitions?
Well, we are, Jeff. And I mean, for us, I mean, the last thing we would need is any sort of a black eye, you know, fraud within our industry. And so we would not support any feedstock, regardless of what it is or where it comes from, that is not truly what it is entitled to be. Now, with that said, you know, we are also a country that, you know, has always supported free trade. And so having products coming in, feedstocks coming into the United States for our industry, that's been going on for decades. Now, maybe not at the volume that we're seeing right now, but the reason we're seeing that volume is because it's happening at exactly the same time as our industry is going through the most significant build-out of production capacity in its history. You know, I spoke earlier about going from 2.5 billion to 5 billion gallons this year is what we think, so a doubling in 4 years. Well, that's possible because during that same time frame, we've over-doubled our production capacity in the United States. So the bottom line is there's some very large facilities that are looking for a lot of feedstock on a daily basis, and those demands are going to be satisfied in some way. You couple that with the fact that this 45Z, the production, clean fuels production tax credit, and then historically the LCFS in California as well, have both built within themselves incentives or priorities for certain feedstocks. For instance, used cooking oil is a good example. Because of its carbon intensity score in the LCFS, and now its likely carbon intensity score under 45Z, you're going to make more money selling your biodiesel or renewable diesel if you make it out of used cooking oil, regardless of where it comes from, than you are if you make it from soybean oil. Now, you can like that or not like it or think it's the right approach, but that is the rules of our game. And so we find our producers are figuring those things out and trying to aggregate these large amounts of feedstock that they need from just about anywhere they can get it in the world. And so the markets will settle out. As we talked earlier, there's some new soybean crush coming online, which is going to significantly increase the availability domestically of soybean oil. So I have all the confidence in the world the market will settle these things out, and things will be on the straight and narrow. But in the meantime, I think to be expected, we'll continue to see imports of all kinds of feedstocks to serve this growing industry here in the United States.
Is there a criteria that defines, or is there testing to define that what is being imported into the country is actually used cooking oil, or if it's palm oil with some mixture into it?
Yeah. Jeff, I know there are some testing available. There's some testing that is available that can give you some determinations. We rely mostly on the Customs and Border Patrol, because there actually is a tariff on these kinds of products coming in the United States. So it's up to them to determine what is this product that's being imported exactly, so they could determine what is the appropriate tariff to apply to that product. So, you know, if there's an opportunity, and we've been in partnership and collaboration with some of our partners in the industry, like NOPA, for instance, on what are some things we can do to enhance that, either implementing some testing procedures. We've got to be careful about that as well to make sure that it's not slowing down the process, you know, to receive those feedstocks. And so to the extent we can see programs like that that can be implemented to, you know, reinforce the veracity of the testing or the certification of those feedstocks coming in, Clean Fuels would be all for that. We just don't want to see that slow down the supply chain, where we have large producers who are having to wait for feedstocks to become available.
Some agriculture groups, some renewable fuel groups have taken up litigation against the EPA over their tailpipe emission standards for vehicle for model years 2027 to 2032. Does Clean Fuels Alliance America have a position on the EPA, what some say is a mandate toward electric vehicles?
Yeah, Jeff, we actually are one of those parties as well that are litigating this with EPA. We just announced that last week, in fact, before our members made their way into Washington, D.C. And so, you know, we just feel like liquid renewable fuels have got to be a part of the solution. There's no reason to look beyond liquid renewable fuels. If you want to look to electrification, that is fine. That's certainly, we're not going to get in the way of that, but you shouldn't look past what you have available to you now. And so, you know, I believe, this is my opinion, the EPA through that process could have also been a little more welcoming to those liquid renewable fuels, and could thereby encouraging the original equipment manufacturers to look to those as possible solutions as well, giving them choices and options rather than feeling like they are being pushed into an electrification corner as well. And so that's going to be the crux of what we're going to be talking about in that litigation as well, just to make sure that clean liquid renewable fuels get a chance to be that part of the solution as well.
One of the arguments has been is that the technology isn't proven yet, but yet there are mandates coming, which is in essence forcing the industry in that particular direction.
Well, and I think that's the one of the roles government can play. You know, we spoke earlier about how actions that governments can take can be helpful or they can be challenging, and at least for our industry, you know, EV mandates can be challenging. Again, we don't have in our specific industry, because we're in medium duty and heavy duty applications, it's certainly not any near term electrification alternatives. When you look at, for instance, locomotives in the railroad industry, those locomotives consume a large amount of diesel fuel. They create a large amount of power, and that just has not been replicated with battery and electric technology. And so I've also learned over the years that locomotives, of course, they're not cheap. They also stay in use for 40 to 50 years many times. So if today there was a 100% solution, a very clean solution to rail transportation that was clean in the form of batteries, let's say, it would take a long, long time, decades, for that to be implemented into a fleet like our railroads. So it's just another example of, again, don't look past what's available today in order to have a long-term vision. We don't fault their long-term vision. Maybe we'll all get there one day, but in the meantime, let's also allow these fuels that are here today. Hence our tagline of our trade association, better, cleaner now.
Well, out of the frying pan and into the fire, perhaps, the Supreme Court has made a ruling on Chevron deference. And now, if there are ambiguous laws, instead of the administrative regulatory agency filling in the blanks as they see fit, it looks like now that falls back either on the courts or it falls back on Congress. And there are a host of issues relating to fuel where the EPA has made decisions. The question is, where do we go from here now?
Well, I think, you know, the worst thing for any industry is uncertainty. So when there's been debate about regulation, about policy, about what was intended by Congress, it always opens up a window of uncertainty. What is the agency going to do? What is EPA, in our case, going to decide about that? And how long is it going to take that process, you know, to work itself out? And so, you know, in some ways, what the Supreme Court has put into place doesn't change the fact that there's going to be a time-consuming period in order for the courts to reengage in that issue and for it to go through that process, or for the Congress to reengage and to try to resolve that problem. So it's very early in kind of taking a look, see at what this ruling from the Supreme Court is really going to mean. I mean, I would tend to think there's going to be some positive in it, some opportunities, but I think at the same time there's going to be some challenges in it as well. And again, for an industry like ours, the most important thing to get rid of is uncertainty, and anytime there's questions about the law that's impacting our industry and what's going to then happen to it, that creates that uncertainty. So we'll just want to hope the process can be fluid and smooth and come to some quick resolution.
Well, the devil's always in the details, and it's hard in a very partisan Congress to come to specifics, easier to prove generalities. But at some point, I's do have to be dotted and T's have to be crossed. As you suggest, we don't need ambiguous rules. We need fair and open rules. And so many legislators have said we need an all-of-the-above approach to energy, but yet the driver of this administration appears to be in one direction.
Well, I think, you know, that ambiguousness, most of the times when we've seen it come into play, a lot of it is because industries develop. Industries, you know, start to grow in different ways. And so you take a law that's been on the books for 10 years and it was built really well. Maybe it's built very solidly around an industry at that time, but that's not where the industry is anymore. So you're still trying to apply a 10-year-old law to a current, you know, the way the industry is currently working. And that's sometimes where that ambiguity comes from. And then everybody's going back through the rulemaking process or litigation or whatever that might be to try to get that answer and that question. I just think, Jeff, that's probably going to be the way things will be for a long time. Otherwise, you don't see industries growing and transitioning like you want them to.
Well, Donnell Rehagen, we want to thank you very much for taking time to be with us on this edition of Open Mic. And it is Open Mic. You have the opportunity to take us home today, sir.
Well, Jeff, thank you, and thank you to your listeners. We're an industry that's growing, and we're very proud of our agricultural roots, and those will always remain prominent and present in what we do. We're glad to be promoting the feedstocks that are important to agriculture, but also important to this country and beyond. The goals of decarbonization. I think your farmer listeners should take an immense amount of pride in what they've been able to accomplish over the last number of decades, not just in our industry, but in ethanol as well, to bring these clean fuels to the marketplace that are allowing current technology engines to utilize clean fuels, and at the same time supporting agriculture. So win-win, you got to love it, Jeff. I appreciate it.
Our thanks to Donnell Rehagen, CEO of Clean Fuels Alliance America, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nally.